Hello and welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Tuesday, January 16th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are myself, Scott Splavik, and my partner, Mary Frances Evans. And here's Mary Frances with our first story.
Looking at the front page of the Quad City Times today, we've got actually one, two, three, four stories. First one is Trump wins caucuses. We have another from the Associated Press, Americans celebrate MLK Jr. holiday. Another one, Rio Grande, a reminder of food in the Southwest. That's from the Best Thing I Ate series. And QCNA, what's been filmed in QC? So we'll start with the big story. If you haven't heard, Trump wins caucuses, and it shows a bunch of folks, Scott County caucus goers, this is a photograph, wait in line to register to caucus at the North Scott High School during the 2024 Iowa Republican caucus. Caucus kicked off across the state Monday with temperatures in the Quad Cities at zero, wind chill close to 20 below. Then it goes on to the story, crucial victory comes as Haley and DeSantis battle for second place. Donald Trump won the Iowa caucuses on Monday, seizing a crucial victory that reinforces the former president's grip on his party at the outset of the GOP's 2024 nomination fight, even as he faces extraordinary legal challenges that could complicate his bid to return to the White House. The magnitude of Trump's success is still coming into focus. It was not immediately clear who would emerge as the second place finisher, either Governor Ron DeSantis or former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. Caucus voters endured life-threatening cold and dangerous driving conditions to participate in meetings that unfolded in hundreds of schools, churches, and community centers across the state. Fourth-place finisher Vivek Ramaswamy ended his campaign later in the night and endorsed Trump. The results are just the first in what will be a months-long effort for Trump to secure the GOP nomination a third consecutive time. But the victory sends an unmistakable message to the Republican Party that the nomination is Trump's to lose and crystallizes the challenge facing his GOP opponents. Trump was already looking ahead to a potential general election matchup against President Joe Biden as he addressed hundreds of cheering supporters at a caucus site at the Horizon Events Center in Clive. "He's totally destroying our country," Trump said of Biden. DeSantis and Haley are Trump's top rivals, both competing with each other to establish themselves as the top alternative to him. Both are already pivoting their focus, with Haley poised to compete vigorously in New Hampshire, where she hopes to be more successful with the state's independent voters heading into the January 23rd primary. DeSantis is heading to New Hampshire on Tuesday, only after a stop in South Carolina, which is a conservative stronghold, where the February 24 contest could prove pivotal. Trump, meanwhile, was expected to fly to New York Monday night so he could be in court on Tuesday, as a jury is poised to consider whether he should pay additional damages to a columnist who last year won a $5 million jury award against Trump for sex abuse and defamation. He will then fly to New Hampshire, the next state in the Republican primary calendar, to hold a rally Tuesday evening. Iowa is an uneven predictor of who will ultimately lead Republicans into the general election. George W. Bush's 2000 victory was the last time a Republican candidate won in Iowa and went on to become the party's standard bearer. Trump showed significant strength among urban, small town, and rural communities, according to AP VoteCast. He also performed well with evangelical Christians and those without a college degree. And a majority of caucus goers said that they identified with Trump's Make America Great Again movement. One relative weakness for Trump comes in the suburbs, where only about 4 out of 10 support him. AP VoteCast is a survey of more than 1,500 voters who said they planned to take part in the caucuses. The survey is conducted by the Associated Press NORC, that's NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy and former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson were also on the ballot in Iowa, as was former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who suspended his campaign last week. And just as an update, all three of those guys are gone by Tuesday when we're reading this. Trump's success tells a remarkable story of a Republican Party unwilling or unable to move on from a flawed frontrunner. He lost to Biden in 2020 after fueling near constant chaos while in the White House, culminating with his supporters carrying out a deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol. In total, he faces 91 felony charges across four criminal cases, including two indictments for his efforts to overturn the election and a third indictment for keeping classified documents in his Florida home. Through it all, Trump has intentionally used his legal problems as a political asset. Over the past week alone, Trump chose to leave the campaign trail on two separate occasions to make voluntary appearances before judges in New York and Washington. Pardon me. In both cases, he addressed the media directly afterward, ensuring national coverage of his legal drama would make it more difficult for his Republican rivals to break through in Iowa. The former president campaigned in Iowa only sporadically over the past year and largely abandoned the state's tradition of intimate appearances in living rooms and small community venues. He instead relied on larger campaign rallies, where he more often listed grievances over the past, most notably his lie that the 2020 election was stolen, rather than articulating a detailed vision for the nation's future. Trump's legal challenges appear to have done little damage to his reputation, as the charges are seen through a political lens. About three quarters say the charges against Trump are political attempts to undermine him, rather than legitimate attempts to investigate important issues, according to AP VoteCast. Still, about one quarter say Trump has done something illegal when it comes to at least one of the legal cases he's facing. His role in the January 6, 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol, his alleged attempts to interfere in the vote count in the 2020 presidential election, or the discovery of classified documents at his Florida home that were supposed to be in government custody. And then it shows a photo of former President Trump speaking to a crowd in Clive on Monday.
Americans celebrate MLK Jr. holiday. Jeff Martin and Jeffrey Collins have provided this article from the Associated Press, and the dateline is Atlanta. Communities across the nation celebrated the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday on Monday with acts of service, prayer services, and parades. But with the November presidential election as a backdrop, some of its events took on an overtly political turn. In King's hometown of Atlanta, several speakers at the 56th annual commemorative service at the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church, where King served as pastor, touched on the divisive partisan climate in the United States. Former U.S. Representative Liz Cheney, who served on the House committee that investigated the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol, had harsh words for Donald Trump, whom she did not mention by name. On that day, Trump's supporters tried to block Congress from counting the Electoral College votes that would affirm Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 presidential race. A former president refuses to acknowledge that he lost, and he has convinced millions that our elections and our democracy no longer work, she said. He threatens the foundations of our nation and everything Dr. King persevered to save. She also criticized some religious leaders in the way they seemed to worship Trump, not God. U.S. Senator Raphael Warnock, the longtime senior pastor of Ebenezer, told the audience, "You better stand up and vote," to rousing applause. "If your vote didn't count, why are folks trying so hard to keep you from voting? Stand and use your voice. Stand up and use your vote. Speak up." Bernice King, the daughter of the late civil rights leader, warned that our humanity is literally under attack. But she noted that her father's legacy of nonviolence taught the world that we can defeat injustice, ignorance, and hold people accountable at the same time without seeking to destroy, diminish, demean, or cancel them. Speaking at the MLK Day at the Dome rally at the South Carolina State House, Vice President Kamala Harris said young people two or three generations removed from King had seen their freedoms shrink, from laws restricting voting to bans on abortions and the ever-present threat of gun violence, especially in schools. They even try to erase, overlook, and rewrite the ugly parts of our past. For example, the Civil War, which, must I really have to say, was about slavery, Harris said. Harris also used her speech at the event, which started in 2000, to pressure the state to remove the Confederate flag from atop the Capitol dome, to urge the younger generation to regain those rights lost through voting action. Generation after generation of the fields of Gettysburg, in the schools of Little Rock, on the grounds of the State House, on the streets of Ferguson, and on the floor of the Tennessee House of Representatives, we the people have always fought to make the promise of freedom real, Harris said. In Philadelphia, President Joe Biden marked Martin Luther King Jr. Day by volunteering at Philabundance, a nonprofit food bank. He stuffed donation boxes with apples and struck up casual chatter with workers at the organization, where he volunteered for the third time as president on president-elect to mark the January Day of Service. The 29th annual Greater Philadelphia Martin Luther King Day of Service is billed as the first and largest King Day of Service in the nation. Volunteer activities included preparing care packages for victims of gun violence and distributing voter information packets. Also in the city, the Philadelphia MLK Association held its annual tapping of the Liberty Bell on Independence Mall, and the National Constitution Center offered free admission with a slate of civil rights era events and a school supply drive. In Washington, Martin Luther King III participated in a wreath-laying event at his father's memorial. In Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers, at a noontime ceremony in the state capitol rotunda, said the holiday is an opportunity to recommit to addressing health disparities, fully funding public schools, and providing affordable housing, childcare, and transportation. Doing that, we can build the sort of future we all want to see for our state, the Democratic former educator said. Meanwhile, a dangerously cold winter storm was limiting some planned activities. The National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis announced that it would be closed on Monday because of icy roads, but would still hold a virtual celebration in honor of King's birthday. The Great Smoky Mountains National Park on the Tennessee-North Carolina border was also closed, canceling a campground cleanup event. Also canceled because of weather was the Martin Luther King Gymnastics Invitational set for Monday at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. The historic meet was to include Fisk, Brown, Iowa State, Rutgers, Talladega, Alabama, and William & Mary. The competition aimed to feature the only African-American women head coaches in the sport for the first time ever. Observed federally since 1986, the holiday occurs on the third Monday of January, which this year happens to be King's actual birthday. Born in 1929, the slain civil rights leader would have been 95 years old. This year also marks the 60th anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act and King's Nobel Peace Prize.
And jumping over to the local page, we've got some photos here in keeping with our last article of Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebrations across the Quad City area. Here's a photo of a man speaking at a podium to a group of people. It says the Reverend Dwight L. Ford speaks at the 41st Annual Memorial Service and Award Ceremony at the MLK Center in Rock Island. And then there's a photo of a young person wearing a letter jacket speaking into a microphone while reading off their phone. And it says, Zakiah Dade, a Youth Expression Contest Award winner, recites a piece she wrote called I Am Me. And then there's another photo of C.J. Parker playing the piano and singing at the service. And then there's the last photo is MLK Center board member Kai Swanson Hugs 2023 I Have a Dream Award winner John Hildreth on Monday at the award service. Keeping it local, Quad City School Board report card. What's happening in local schools? Here is a roundup of key highlights and agenda items from recent local school board meetings. Pleasant Valley Community School District. Last week, Pleasant Valley school leaders approved district calendars, policies, and gave several students and staff recognitions. All board members present, January 8th's meeting kicked off with a slew of communications. And here are the bullet points. Director Jamison Smith congratulated wrestlers Carter Seibel and Caden Irvin for earning 100 varsity wins. He also congratulated sophomore Abigail Meyer, one of 15 statewide nominated for Iowa Wrestle's Ms. Dan Gable, Wrestler of the Year. I never thought I'd hear that. Ms. Dan Gable, Wrestler of the Year. Next bullet, Superintendent Brian Strutz recognized Becky Larson, who is a fifth grade teacher at Bridgeview Elementary School, and Glenn Neighbor, a junior high wellness teacher, for their 25 and 30 years of service, respectively. Next bullet, Director of Secondary Curriculum Bernie Breskern recognized a list of students selected for the Southeast Iowa Bandmaster Association Honor Band. And she also introduced Platinum Dance Team coaches Katie Rakuzek, Maddie Strutz, and Jamie Fowles. The board congratulated the team for their 2023 state titles. Strutz and the board also took time to offer condolences to the Perry, Iowa community following the recent school shooting there. You can hear all recognitions in full. You can watch their live stream on the Pleasant Valley Community School District YouTube channel. After unanimously approving all consent agenda items and monthly bills, the board held public hearings on the following items and more bullets. District hours. The hours-based 2024-25 school year calendar, along with meeting dates. Next bullet. The district's Children's Internet Protection Act policy per federal and state guidelines. These were initially approved at the November 27th meeting with no public comment. Excuse me. Each of these items was unanimously approved by the board. Because of board members' questions relating to policy verbiage, further Children's Internet Protection Act clarifications may come back to the board at a future date. The board generally meets on the second and fourth Monday of every month, 6 p.m., and you can check them out at, you can look at their calendars at the Pleasant Valley School website, which is pleasval.org or pleasval.org. Now we're jumping to the North Scott Community School District. North Scott leaders made more facility progress last week. Molly Bergfeld was the only school board member absent. Because of the winter storm forecast, the following agenda items were rescheduled to February. Those include board awards, the Junior High Lego League presentation, and the district's gradual release of responsibility presentation. Then they held public hearings on the following items, the 2024-25 calendar, a bidding timeline for the future high school wrestling facility renovation per the North Scott Vision 2025 strategic facility plan. This project will come to the board for approval at the next board meeting. Next is a resolution to use district SAVE, and that's Secure and Advanced Vision for Education revenues, toward the wrestling project. It's estimated to total $1 million in construction costs. Next bullet, a bidding timeline for the Neil Armstrong Elementary School's future gym and classroom addition, also a North Scott Vision 2025 project. These bids are due 2 p.m. the 31st of January. Each of these items was unanimously approved. And here's some highlights from that. Here's a bullet. A $285,178 bid from school bus sales for two new school buses, 72 passengers each for next year. A nearly $1,144,412 supplemental funding request for the district's at-risk and dropout prevention program for next year. An $80,000 change order with Southern Bleacher Company for the first phase of Lancer Stadium renovations, and that brings the project cost down to $2,243,200. Resolution for the sale of $25 million in general obligation bonds in fiscal 2024. In his procedural report, Superintendent Joe Studding gave regular enrollment in NS Vision 2025 update. As of January 1, North Scott's enrollment was 3,455 students. Interior painting had begun for the Alan Shepard Elementary School addition. Weather will put the Regional Innovation Center construction on hold in the coming weeks. The exterior paneling so far is a good sign for the project's progress. Now the Rock Island Milan School District. They hired a new district leader, approved discipline plans, and talked strategic planning last week. All members present. They gave kudos to the district's fine arts program, noting that 14 all-state musicians were there this school year. As usual, he also gave an update on the district's Project Now Head Start program and the Black Hawk Area Special Education Agency. Many board members gave a welcome to Lanty McGuire, the district's interim second semester superintendent, as well as students and staff coming out of winter break. He said it was an honor and a pleasure to serve Rock Island Milan Schools in his interim role, reflecting on his time as a former educator in the district. And then we have a bunch of bullets. As previously reported, they hired Dr. Sharon Williams as the district's new superintendent effective July 1. Hiring Melody Oswald as the interim principal at Longfellow Elementary School for the remainder of this school year. The district's 2024 Discipline Improvement Plan per Illinois State Board of Education guidelines. A slew of board policy revisions. They worked on their strategic plan. And then here are some of the strategic priorities for that school district. A bullet, engage all stakeholders through building respectful relationships, improve academic outcomes and close the achievement gaps through ensuring equity and opportunities for all students, enhance and improve operations. A district satisfaction survey from this fall reported an 85% satisfaction rate from student respondents, alongside nearly 93% for parents and guardians and 87% satisfaction for staff. Parent-guardian survey participation was at 28% this fall. That's down 3.8% from last fall. For students, the participation rate was 59%. That's down almost 12% from last fall. Other notable data points, a 39% decrease in in-school suspensions from last fall. While the district has increased its non-white enrollment count, the percentage of that demographic, 46%, has remained the same as 22-23 school year. There's been a nearly 18% increase in out-of-school suspensions from last fall's rate, 18%. Kindergarten reading proficiency landed at almost nearly 50% this fall, aligning with the district's end-of-year goal. For math, 56% of district kindergartners were proficient. They retained 90% of their teachers from last school year. Establishing building-level discipline teams will meet quarterly. Continued professional development participation, focusing on trauma-informed care, alternatives to suspension and restorative practices. And the district's top five discipline infractions include, in another list of bullets, violence with no serious injury, defiance, disrespect, insubordination, and noncompliance, threat of violence, disruption, and verbal altercation. It says, moving forward, Rock Island Milan leaders will focus on the following disciplinary steps. This is according to the Illinois State Board of Education guidelines. Continue exploring alternative options to suspension, such as implementing new skill-building options, like continue expanding positive behavior referrals, offer appropriate and available resources, sources like counselors and stuff. Increase parental involvement. Continue exploring professional development on non-exclusionary options for administrators. You can view each of these presentations on that school's website, which is RIMSD as in dog 41.org.
Out of Aledo, Illinois, trash pickup services change. Trash pickup services will change in Aledo, the city and lakeshore recycling systems announced in a news release. Beginning this month, residents and businesses in Aledo will start to see deliveries of garbage carts by Lakeshore, formerly Jackson Disposal, in preparation for automated pickup services. The changes stem from an effort to create a more efficient and cost-effective trash and recycling pickup system for residents. Customers will continue to receive service on their regularly scheduled collection days. City Administrator Michael Chouse said the new system should hopefully bring a smooth and efficient pickup for city residents and businesses. We encourage everyone to begin using the new carts as soon as possible, and we appreciate your cooperation in making the transition as smooth as possible, Chouse said. Lakeshore will begin delivering new garbage carts on Monday, January the 29th, to customers who do not already have LRS or Jackson-provided trash carts. The carts will be delivered at no charge to customers. There also are no changes to the recycling collection service, and customers should continue using their current recycling bin or cart for pickup. Residents also will see a change in the cost of trash service and will no longer be required to pay a rental fee for their carts. The new monthly fee is $17.95, and LRS customers will see this updated amount on their February utility billing notices. Effective February 4th, LRS will no longer service personal garbage can or containers, and all trash and recycling items must be placed in the LRS-provided cart. From Bettendorf, water damage closes hospital main entrance. Unity Point Health Trinity Bettendorf's open to the public, but the main entrance is closed until further notice. The hospital announced Monday afternoon the main entrance was impacted by water damage because of extreme temperatures. The closure is expected to last 1 week. Those who need to access the hospital are asked to enter through the emergency department doors. This includes patients scheduled for echograms, labs, MRIs, nuclear medicine, pulmonary function, radiology, surgery, vascular labs, and women's imaging. Patients with scheduled appointments in the medical office building should use the south entrance. This includes Unity Point Clinic Family Medicine, Unity Point Clinic Internal Medicine of Bettendorf, Unity Point Clinic Multi-Specialty Bettendorf, Unity Point Clinic OBGYN Bettendorf, Unity Point Clinic OBGYN Utica Ridge Road, Unity Point Clinic Pediatrics Bettendorf, Unity Clinic Surgery Bettendorf, Unity Point Health Trinity Center for Wound Care Bettendorf, Unity Point Health Trinity Pain Management Bettendorf, and additional physician offices include Cardiovascular Medicine PC, Fresenius Kidney Care, Infinity Medical Group, Metro MRI at Terrace Park, and Renal Care Associates SC.
And here's some health news. Delayed positivity. Why your at-home test may be taking longer to show that you've got COVID-19. With COVID-19 rising this winter, and here in Des Moines, it seems like it's everywhere, it's getting more complicated to discern whether you are infected. Dr. Elizabeth Hudson, Regional Chief of Infectious Diseases at Kaiser Permanente, Southern California, said she has noticed it's sometimes taking longer after the onset of symptoms for rapid tests to return a positive result. Used to be that someone might test positive 1 or 2 days after the onset of symptoms using a rapid test. Now, positive results might show up until the 4th day after symptoms start. What is causing the lag? The delay in accurate test results is probably a result of people having accumulated immunity from COVID-19 over the years, whether from vaccinations or previous infections, Hudson said. It's actually pushing back the time that people's COVID tests are coming up positive. So some people are testing at day 1 and 2 and saying, oh, it's negative, I don't have COVID, Hudson said. If they probably tested themselves a couple of days later, there's a pretty good chance it actually would turn out to be COVID. People who initially test negative for COVID, despite having symptoms and don't retest later, quote, could be getting a false sense of security that they don't have the illness when they actually do and when they're contagious, Hudson said. So what are the recommendations for testing? Test immediately if you have symptoms of COVID-19, says the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. If you take an at-home rapid test, also referred to as an antigen test, a positive result is usually reliable. But a negative test does not always mean you don't have COVID. It can take a few days for virus levels to reproduce in quantities high enough to be detected by a rapid test. If you test negative and have COVID symptoms, the CDC suggests taking a second test 48 hours later. In the meantime, because you are ill, officials say you should stay home and away from other people, or mask up if you need to be around others. Another option is head to your medical provider to take a PCR test. That generally means going into a medical facility and having your test processed by a lab. That test is much more sensitive, and that positive test result would come up sooner, Hudson said. But most people are relying on taking at-home tests. And if that second at-home test is negative, experts recommend taking another one 4 days after the onset of those symptoms. They should really probably on day four retest themselves if they're doing the home test, Hudson said. What if you are asymptomatic but you've been exposed? You should get tested 5 days after you were last exposed to someone who was infected with COVID-19, the CDC says. If the test is negative, take another at-home test 2 days later or a PCR test as soon as you can. If the second at-home test result is negative, take a third at-home test 2 weeks after the second. We're never supposed to editorialize on IRS, but I'll tell you, I'm staring at these words and I'm confused. Are there any other times when it's helpful to test? Testing before an event or visiting someone who is at high risk can be helpful, the CDC says. Sometimes a rapid test can detect an infection before symptoms even begin. It's also possible a rapid test can detect an infection for someone who is asymptomatic. Test as close to the time of the event as possible, at least within 1 or 2 days. If you use an antigen test, follow recommendations for repeat testing to be confident in a negative result. Where do we stand with COVID-19? Coronavirus cases are up, but the number of people becoming seriously ill remains lower than last year, when hospitals were deluged by a tripledemic of COVID, flu, and respiratory RSV. I'm just going to say RSV. Nationally, there were 34,798 new coronavirus positive hospital admissions for the week that ended December 30th. That was a 20% jump over the prior week, and that was the highest 1 week total in nearly a year. Last winter peaked at 44,542 new hospital admissions for that week. Since October 1 of this year, the CDC has reported an average about 1,400 COVID deaths a week nationally. Over the same time last year, there were about 2,400 weekly COVID deaths. And how can you get a test? The U.S. government is allowing residents to order free at-home COVID tests through their website, covidtests.gov. People are able to order 4 free at-home tests per household. If they didn't already place an order between September 25 and November 19, they are eligible for 2 separate orders of 4 tests. In general, doctors and health plans remain responsible for providing free tests to patients assigned to them. At-home tests are also on sale at pharmacies and online retailers. The CDC set up a testing locator website that displays sites that offer free COVID tests for uninsured people who are ill or who have been exposed to the virus. And the website is to look up where they're testing is testinglocator.cdc.gov.
You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. There are no obituaries in today's paper, so we'll move on to the opinion section. And we've got another view from the Kingsport, Tennessee Times News entitled Crashes Fall, Lives Saved with Cameras. Red light devices prove effective despite legal claims and noise enforcement is next. Red light cameras work. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety says they reduce accidents caused by running red lights by at least 21%, and that saves lives. But even as states and localities continue to debate whether to allow red light cameras, a new device is emerging, acoustic cameras, which crack down on noisy vehicles. Knoxville, Tennessee has installed them. While cities in half the states are using red light cameras, as of June, 8 states have banned them. Their argument is that the Constitution guarantees the accused be confronted with witnesses against them. Since a camera, not a person, witnessed the offense, such violations are said to be constitutionally suspect. As well, the ticket generated by the red light camera is issued to the owner of the vehicle and not the driver. To get around these issues, the ticket in most places is nothing more than a civil fine, making enforcement and collection difficult. Governments have avoided that problem by requiring payment of the fine before motorists can renew a driver's license or auto registration. But there's no arguing that red light cameras save lives. Injuries and the cost of repairs. Those who have lost loved ones in T-bone accidents caused by someone who ran a red light likely see the value in placing them at intersections where most accidents occur. Kingsport, Tennessee did that, and accidents went down. Kingsport's experience is similar to most communities. The number of citations issued is falling each year, providing evidence of reduced violations. Now come noise cameras as technology continues to advance. Though not a safety issue, loud noises offend the senses, and cities from New York and Washington, D.C. to Knoxville and Albuquerque are studying them. Knoxville has them installed, but as yet is not ticketing offenders, but other communities are. Just as in a red light camera, a loud car, typically one exceeding 85 decibels, causes the acoustic camera to snap a photo of the car's license plate and a ticket is mailed to the owner. And just as in red light cameras, opponents are using the same arguments against them. One argument that fails, however, was heard when Kingsport installed red light cameras at several dangerous intersections, that being that the cameras invade privacy. But driving is a regulated activity, and people who obtain licenses to engage in it are agreeing to abide by certain rules on the public streets. Red light safety cameras are a way to catch people who break those rules, just like traditional enforcement, and so will acoustic cameras. In the middle of the last century, young drivers in particular would modify their vehicles to make them louder. They liked the attention it brought them. Today, that problem is not what it once was, but it seems inevitable that where technology can support our public safety agencies, it will be deployed. And that's a good thing.
And sticking with the opinion page, we have a political cartoon by Steve Breen. That's B-R-E-E-N. And there are three people. This is one panel. It shows President Biden lying on the floor on his back with one arm up, kind of like he's waving. And then there is a donkey and an elephant standing nearby looking at him. They're both wearing suits. And the donkey says, "The seasoned public servant offers a reassuring wave as he rests before the big race." And then the elephant is saying, "The old guy, realizing he's a spent force, desperately reaches for help." And that's our political cartoon on the Quad City Times today. And here's a piece from L.Z. Granderson of the Los Angeles Times. And it says, "Working while sick has become a terrible new normal. January is the month to sign up for stuff you're probably not going to keep doing later, like cooking class or hot yoga. It's also the month for setting goals, especially at work, where goals often come with a lunch and a side of office politics. Suffice to say, January is not the month to be sick, and yet millions of us are. A wave of infections has 38 states dealing with, quote, high or very high levels of respiratory illness because of COVID, RSV, and the flu, according to the CDC. Symptoms range from sore throats and coughs that won't go away to fevers that refuse to break. So far, more than 100,000 people have been hospitalized from flu this season, with 6,500 deaths. COVID is surging, but more than 80% of adults have yet to get an updated booster. The CDC expects the wave of illnesses to expand to pretty much the entire country. That's why doctors are advising people to stay home from work if they're sick. But who wants to use sick days in January? You've got 11 more months ahead, and you might end up much sicker later on. Besides, what does too sick to come to the office even mean for workers who do their jobs remotely? If you're too sick to go to the office, that should mean you're too sick to work. Yet we work because we're not that sick. We're something in between. This is a glitch in the hybrid work life. Before the pandemic, staying home from work meant something. You were out sick. People knew about it. Friends would show concern. In a cutthroat workplace, maybe rivals would take note of how many days you miss and see signs of weakness to exploit. So I've heard anyway. Since the pandemic began and so many people have worked remotely, staying home from work means much less. It's harder for folks who can work remotely to justify using a sick day because technology makes it so easy to limp along through our tasks when we should be resting. It's an unspoken norm that benefits capital, regardless of how much sick time workers theoretically can take. This current wave of illnesses has many hybrid employees in this weird limbo where we're just productive enough to keep going, but we're sick and we probably should stop. But how do you tell your supervisor you cannot work from home while ill, when we all just saw civilization work through a global pandemic? And even if you did take a legit sick day off, chances are you still checked your email or Slack, because technology is also addictive, and we just love to scroll. That's how I learned 2024 is an 8-year in numerology. When you add each digit in 2024, you reach a total of 8. That makes this an auspicious year to take action. Go after your dreams. Except many of us are starting this 8-year sick, and those who can work from home are probably going to do so, despite not feeling well, because that's the new normal. We worked when we had COVID and brain fog. We worked with long COVID and brain fog. Now, unless you're in the hospital, you just work. Last year, a record 44% of employees worldwide said they were stressed, according to Gallup. But before you start blaming your younger generations, the stress level of employees around the world has been steadily climbing for more than a decade. It would seem the more advanced our technology gets, the more stressful working life becomes. So here's a thought for goal setting this season. Maybe your ambition this year should be to take a real day off when you're sick. And that's from LZ Granderson of the Los Angeles Times.
Now it's time to move over to the sports page. Sports on TV today include college men's basketball at 5:30 p.m. on FS1, Butler at Xavier. 6 p.m. on Peacock, it's Purdue at Indiana. 6 p.m. on ESPN, it's Florida at Tennessee. 6 p.m. on ESPN2, it's Syracuse at Pittsburgh. FS1 at 7:30 has St. John at Seton Hall. At 8 on ESPN, it's Kansas at Oklahoma State. At 8 on ESPNU, it's Georgia at South Carolina. And at 8 p.m. on the ACC network, it's Georgia Tech at Clemson. And at 9:30 p.m. on FS1, it's Utah State at New Mexico. College women's basketball at 8 p.m. tonight on Peacock, it's Wisconsin at Iowa. The NBA 6:30 TNT features Denver at Philadelphia. And at 9 p.m. on TNT, it's the Oklahoma City Thunder, I believe, up versus the LA Clippers. The National Hockey League, 7:30 p.m., San Jose Sharks take on the Chicago Blackhawks on the NBC Chicago Sports Channel. And in tennis at, I'm going to guess, 8 p.m., it's the Australian Open on ESPN. Story from the front page of the sports section. Cricky Dicks lead Iowa's road win at Minnesota. McCaffrey sets new coaching record. Dateline is Minneapolis. Ben Cricky scored 25 points. Josh Dix, who got the start in place of an injured Patrick McCaffrey, added 21 points. And Iowa beat Minnesota 86-77 on Monday night to make Fran McCaffrey the winningest coach in program history. Fran McCaffrey, who is in his 28th season as a head coach and 14th at Iowa, won his 272nd game as a Hawkeye, passing Dr. Tom Davis for the most victories in program history. On January the 6th, McCaffrey won his 127th career Big Ten game to move past Davis for the most league victories. Dix scored 8 straight Iowa points, capped by a pull-up jumper with 7:07 left for a 67-56 lead. Minnesota got as close as 5 points from there, but Owen Freeman's dunk and subsequent free throw pushed Iowa's advantage to 78-67 with a minute 27 seconds remaining. Tony Perkins added 13 points, and Freeman had 12 points and 8 rebounds for Iowa. McCaffrey did not play due to an ankle injury. Dawson Garcia scored 30 points for Minnesota. Joshua Ola Joseph added 15 points, and Cam Christie scored 12. Iowa won its third straight game in Minneapolis for the first time since 1954 through 56. Former Iowa star Luca Garza, the National Player of the Year in 2021, sat behind the Hawkeyes bench. Garza, now a member of the Minnesota Timberwolves, is the school's men's leader in scoring at 2,306 points. Caitlin Clark became Iowa's all-time career scoring leader on Sunday with 2,813 points. Iowa returns home to play number 2 Purdue on Saturday. Minnesota goes on the road to play Michigan State on Thursday.
And front page of the sports section, big photo of some young local wrestlers. Bettendorf's Jace Luna ranked number 2 at 132 pounds. The Bulldogs had their home tournament canceled by the weather. The headline is Bettendorf wrestlers rounding into form. 12-team shootout wiped out by weekend weather. This is from Dave Selvig of the Times. Mounds of snow and bitter cold gave Bettendorf's wrestlers a midwinter break it did not want last weekend. The Bulldogs notched 2 dual wins on Thursday, but that was it before the storm blew through and knocked out the 12-team Bettendorf shootout that was scheduled for Friday and Saturday. Coach Dan Knight said they even tried to push the meet to Monday, but extreme cold temperatures prevented teams from traveling. We tried to make it work, but the weather kind of delivered a 1-2 blow with the snow and the cold, Knight said. We were looking forward to a good weekend, but it was not to be, unfortunately. Knight found plenty of positives in dual wins over Pleasant Valley and Clinton. TJ Kester, that's 126 pounds, Jace Luna at 132, Lincoln Jip at 165, and Braden Koster at 190. Each accounted for 12 points with a pair of pins as the Bulldogs pushed their record to 17-2. Jake Knight, 120, Cody Trevino, 128, and Javen Dean, his first name is spelled J-A-V-E-N, at 144, also went 2-0. Their only losses are to a strong Minnesota program, Chatfield, Minnesota, and Indianola in Waterloo. The Bulldogs have not been at full strength yet this season. Injury and illnesses have been an issue, but the results have remained steady. I think we're wrestling pretty well. We took a couple of losses, but you learn as much from those as you do from anything, Knight said. I think the team is starting to come together. In the latest HWP rankings, Bettendorf is number 2, behind only Southeast Polk. Both teams will be in Urbandale this weekend for the loaded Ed Winger Invitational. Fort Dodge ranked number 3 along with Ankeny Centennial and Waukee Northeast are also expected to be in attendance among several other high-level squads. In a lot of weight classes, you're going to have several ranked kids, Knight said. Pardon me. It's similar to the state tournament. I'm going to go ahead and wrap up on that because I'm going to have a cough here.
All right. In other prep wrestling, young UT wrestlers show promise. Panthers 9-2 in dual matches. This is written by Samir Mala of the QC Times. After dropping two of its last three dual meets to Western Big Six Conference teams in Geneseo and Moline, the young United Township Panthers wrestling team looks to rebound in the second half of the season. So far, our team is doing well and is much improved from last season, United Township coach Lambros Fotos said. The majority of our lineup are freshmen and sophomores, so it's been a big step for us having a young team competing better. The 9-2 Panthers have 12 freshmen and 18 sophomores helping fill the 13 weight classes, accounting for exactly 75% of the United Township's roster. We were going to have a lot of growing pains with many kids in the varsity lineup for the first time, Fotos said. Our focus was to stick with the basics, improve on them as the season continued. Our guys have been doing a good job becoming better competitors throughout the season. One of those freshmen is 106-pounder Blake Tricky. Tricky has been a pleasant surprise in this season, Fotos said. He currently has 20 wins and 4 loss record and won his first varsity tournament at Morton this past weekend. Despite the large number of underclassmen on the Panthers roster, Fotos appreciates that there is more interest in the sport compared to this time last year. It helps having more bodies, Fotos said. It has made a big difference in the practice room, making it more competitive for everyone on a daily basis. The Panthers' best wrestler is junior 157-pounder Caden Maroth, who sports a 23-5 record. Maroth is one of our leaders and is a great competitor, Fotos said. He has been performing well at tournaments recently. United Township started the season 8-0 in dual meets, winning by an average score of 60-20. However, the Panthers fell to Moline 55-18 and to Geneseo 61-12 on December 14th and January 8th, their first two losses of the season. For dual matches, there's been pros and cons, Fotos said. We've improved throughout the year. Since the conference tournament determines conference champs and the all-conference team, we've looked at our duels just as preparation for the tournament at the end of January. The Panthers have been solid in the local tournaments this season, finishing in the middle of the pack at the Morton Invitational, 6th of 18 teams, the Sabre Invitational, 11th of 14 teams, the Riverdale Tournament, 6th of 16 teams, and the Rockford East Tournament, 9th out of 24 teams. In the Sabre Invitational, sophomore Xavier Marloff had the best finish, earning runner-up honors against Max Howe of Mid Prairie. UT senior Alex Long earned a third-place finish. Winning close matches is something the Panthers are looking to improve on. We need to know how to win those tight matches, Fotos said. Toward the end of the year, in the postseason, there is no easy route to advance to sectionals and to state, especially in Class 3A. If our guys are prepared to wrestle and win those big matches at the end of the year, it would be huge for our individuals and for our team as a whole. And in the NFL, if you didn't catch last night's game, the Buffalo Bills defeated the Steelers 31-17. And Tampa Bay defeated the Eagles 32-9. One final thing, Storm become Gators this weekend. First, it was Winter Storm Finn that blew into the Quad Cities and dumped upward of 8 inches of snow on the Quad City area early last week. Right on the heels of that came Winter Storm Jerry, which shut down just about everything late in the week and nearly a foot of snow and Arctic temperatures locking down the area over the weekend. Feeling as if locals have had enough of storms, the local minor hockey league team figured it was time for a rebrand. There will be no storm this coming weekend, at least on the ice at Vibrant Arena at the Mark. Team officials announced Monday that for this weekend's two-game series against Knoxville at Vibrant Arena, the Quad City franchise will take the ice under a new name and new look, and it will make for an interesting matchup of SPHL teams, as the rebranded Quad City Ice Gators will host the Ice Bears on both Friday and Saturday evenings. According to QC President Brian Rothenberger, the planned rebrand and the winter weather blasts were absolutely coincidental, but it worked out perfectly for the team. "We think people are sick of storms right now," he said with a chuckle after making the rebrand announcement. A special event, Rothenberger said, has been done by other hockey franchises across all levels. The nickname Ice Gators rebrand might seem random to some, but there's a reason for picking that name. This is a spin-off of the former Louisiana Ice Gators, which was the franchise before the storm, said Rothenberger. When John Dawson, QC Storm owner, purchased the franchise from the SPHL, it had previously been the Ice Gators. "This is a little bit of a nod to that and an idea to help keep things fresh. Everyone who's familiar with the Ice Gators really likes it." That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today, Tuesday, January the 16th, 2024. I'm Scott Splavik, and my partner at the microphone. Listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.